So, to introduce Damien Barr, Damien is a journalist, Radio 4 playwright, host of the Soho House Literary Salon, man about town, flaneur, cultural entrepreneur, all of these things. He's dedicated his life to discovering new lifestyle and social trends, new people, new places. In 2006, he published Get It Together, Surviving Your Quarter Life Crisis, which was subsequently serialized in the Times and featured on Richard and Judy, no less. Fine accolade, yes. And he made headlines across the world for his pioneering role as the world's first ever reader in residence, which means he now spends a month a year being paid to stay in five-star hotels reading stories aloud to guests. You can really go off someone quite quickly. He lives in Brighton, he keeps chickens, and depending on which websites you visit, he either has an addiction to dams and gin or spends his evenings tirelessly mixing martinis in an ultimately futile quest to find perfection. Please welcome Damien Barr.
I love that. All that emphasis on booze makes me sound really suspicious. And I've got wine here, which I think is very civilised. Now, can we have the house lights down, please? Because I think I look better in semi-shade. Good. A little bit more? Good, that's enough. Welcome, everybody, to what has been described as and is undoubtedly the highlight of this, the 7th Small Wonder Festival. I'm your host, and I'm very surprised and pleased to be here after last year's slam, where I threatened to milk one of the participants in the barn next door. Is he here? Slightly disappointed that he's not. I was going to follow through on that. Well, I wasn't, but the machine was. In any case, and this year's winner is back from last year. Can you please make yourself known to the room? Ooh, there he is. Once again, £100 is up for grabs. Now, thanks to devaluation and in the current economic climate, that's actually worth nothing. But thanks to further inflation in the festival's reputation, it's worth even more glory than ever before. More than the Booker, more than the Orange, more indeed than anything. So somebody tonight is going to be a winner. Unfortunately, not everyone is going to get to read, but we'll get to the rules in a minute. So tonight we'll see one of you emerge as the master or mistress of the medium best suited to our attention-starved times. Each text we send is a short story, providing that it's not a picture of your cat or something else. And on the mobile phone, the thought, not that anybody can get reception here, but make sure they're all off. That would be lovely. As I said in the piece in today's Brighton Argus, which I'm sure you've all read, flash fiction is not an extract of a longer story or a part of something else. It's a believable, self-contained world which makes us ask questions of it and ourselves. Your flash fiction should have a beginning, a middle, and an end. Jim Crace, who is Jim? Is John your brother? Is Jim, Mr. Devil's Larder, are you related at all with us? So an intensely contemporary connection between John Crace, whose event was earlier, and Jim Crace. I didn't think there could be too many Craces. Jim Crace's The Devil's Larder has one of my favourite pieces of super flash fiction in it, and it is a two-word story, and it is this. Oh, honey. And it can be short and sweet, or, depending on how you say it, admonishing, ensnaring, or possibly even in a slightly creepy way, encouraging. The classic short story is a way of avoiding the novella, and the novella is a way of avoiding the novel, which is a way of avoiding a proper job. And flash fiction is a way of avoiding all of that. So tonight we will celebrate flash fiction, and one of you will have even more to reason to celebrate, as you will win. Tonight's title, as you will have guessed from our wonderfully literal slide behind me, I'm sure your stories will be so much more, you know, interpretive, is The Key. You've all been unlocking this title, grown. And I look forward to hearing what you found. So, you each have 3 minutes. Last year, I think, was 5 minutes. And in some cases, that was an eternity. So we're going to go for 3 very brief minutes, because that's really about all I can handle. At that point, I'm going to shout stop. Now, Zoe's here. Zoe is my kind of Debbie McGee figure, which makes me Paul Daniels, obviously. Round of applause, please, for Zoe. Welcome. Zoe's going to be doing the scoring because I can't do maths, and Zoe's got a calculator as well, haven't you? Yes, good. That demonstrates that we have power. And our judges, we have four judges. They are Diana Reich, the artistic director, Colm McKenzie, Freya McClements from the Irish Times, and Camilla, who runs the best bookshop in Ireland. So a round of applause for our judges, please. When you're applauding, our judges will be scoring out of 10 in a kind of come down with me style manner. And when you're applauding, if you can really sort of let the judges feel the love, then they'll be influenced by that. They won't be influenced by money or anything else, but you can try. I am influenced by money. I will be around in the interval, and I will be judging the shortlists at the end. That's all I'm saying. So I'm trying to think what other rules and things I have to tell you. Well, let's see. The bus won't leave without you. I think that's the most important thing for you to know. For those of you who are getting the bus will not leave without you. It will wait until the slam ends. I still, in my pocket right now, have the cheque for £100. And I think probably that's about it. There's a few more bits of housekeeping, but we'll do it as we go. So, to our first story, which is mine. Yeah. Thanks for that. Thank you for that subdued round of applause. Faint praise. I've gone with a kind of a sort of a love story. Anyway, so I should time myself as well, shouldn't I? This is the stopwatch. Has it been independently verified? No, I don't want you to time me because that's too stressful. You independently verified it. Good. Okay, so you'll know if I go over. I'm sure you're all timing it anyway. You're that mean. So, okay, and it's obviously called The Key. The key thing is, you've both got to love yourselves before you can really love each other. Self-love is key. Simon struggles not to snigger at this talk of self-love. Instead, he adopts his serious listening face and stares out the window of the therapist's office. The view is of a red brick wall that's crumbling even faster than his marriage. Sarah can't look at Simon because she knows he's trying not to laugh, and if he laughs, she will too. She feels sad knowing him so well and not at all anymore. Instead, she adopts her empathy face and stares over the therapist's head through her halo of curly hair to a picture on the wall. She thinks the kiss is an ironic choice for a marriage counsellor. Inside, she feels like the scream. The key thing is, you've both got to move beyond hate. You've got to get the hate out and let the love in. Getting the hate out is key. Simon thinks this therapist has more keys than a jailer. She must jangle when she walks, swaying hips made large with vegetarian curries and clad in shapeless linen trousers the colour of quinoa. Sarah is wishing the therapist was more like Oprah, who she likes to watch when Simon is at work. When he came home early one day and found her with Oprah, it was somehow worse than when she caught him with porn. She should have been preparing to go back to work after the failure of this final cycle of treatment. The key thing is, you've got to stop blaming each other and allow one another to grieve. The key thing is accepting your losses. Simon is thinking about cutting his losses. He imagines standing up and walking away from this chronically sincere woman with all the hair and ethnic bangles which jangle percussively when she waves her hands in the air as if conducting their feelings. Sneaking a look at her clock, he sees they have 20 minutes left of their session, but if he left now, he's not sure Sarah would come with him. Sarah catches him glancing at the clock. She doesn't want to be here either, but wouldn't be so obvious. She thinks about the clock inside her and how it has stopped forever. She wills them both to tick into life. Neither obeys. She thinks about leaving, but she's not sure Simon would come with her. The therapist notes them both looking at the small travel clock that sits patiently by her side, guarding her time. She feels hurt, then feels concerned about feeling hurt, because that means she probably hasn't put very good boundaries in place with these clients. She worries they don't like her, even though she knows she shouldn't care. She likes them. She wants them to be in love again. She wants to smoosh them both to her generous breasts, which have never fulfilled their natural purpose. She transmits so much love at them, her hair actually curls. Slowly, two hands explore the void between two chairs. His hand finds her hand, 10 fingers locked together. That is the key thing. Oh. Thank you very much, Judgy. Sadly, I'm not allowed to win that £100. See, not just frivolous. Okay, I'm going to get my hat and pick. You can hear me now a little bit, right? Yes, you can. This is my kind of Jeremy Kyle moment. So, the first name is on the top of the hat, and I'm going to invite up Sarah Humphrey. Sarah Humphrey? Come on, where are you? She's coming from the back. She's going to step over and through people. Okay. I'm going to sit over here and look at you. I should add that as this is cabaret-style seating, I have a bottle of wine here, which I plan to get through this evening. I'm fairly sure I'll need it. I encourage you to drink heavily. Okay, Sarah. Go.
I have spent endless hours trying to find the key that will unlock this door. The blank ivory walls, devoid of direction. Adorned with a plastic picture of an outdoor scene. Grasses, trees and water. And I think of you. My throat is dry, sucked clean of moisture by the regulated air. I couldn't swallow if I tried, and my silent tears dried long ago. Hours pass. Days merge under strip lights, caged so self-inflicted damage can't be done. I lay alone, with only bleak thoughts of death to pass the time. There are others. Occasional visits from strange faces that all dress the same. But words don't work here, and no one will give me the key. The one thing I need to free me from this annex to the world. Without sustenance, my body feels leaden, a dead weight dragging me to the bowels of the earth where my mind lays buried. My eyes unseeing, my skin unfeeling, my body aching for pain just to validate my waning life. In my dying brain, I know that I knew the answers once, and how to reclaim the outside world by passing through a door, a window, constricting my childhood body through wooden fences with seamless ease. What was second nature has now become sentiment and cannot help me. If only I could send a message. I sense more than know that I am being watched, monitored by incessant bleeps and flashing lights. I try to think that even if I could, the key is gone. I lost reality when I watched you lose life, screaming at my crimson traitor's hands. And then the white-coated men came, armed with sedatives and probing pain, and traded my life for yours. Yet of one thing I am certain, they have already thrown away the key.
Yeah. Brevity there being the soul of insanity. And sit at 1 minute 46 seconds, impressive. 6447, which I think is a number like 20. Is it 20?
21.
Give or take, that's fine. Okay, let's go next to... There's an unauthorised-looking piece of lined paper in here. I know. It's because we changed the seating. People think they can do what they want. Linda McVeigh. Linda McVeigh, please come up. Oh, she's right there. That's handy. Yeah, I've got that.
It was Colin's suggestion. Come on, he says. You're always complaining we don't do things as a couple. It might be fun. So I agree, as long as he understands it's a one-off, a trial. The house looks normal. White necks at the window, milk bottles on the doorstep, a people carrier in the drive. Colin says the big pampas grass in the middle of the lawn is a signal. The botanical equivalent of a secret handshake. I'd rather not think about that. After all, my parents had a pampas when they lived in Burgess Hill. There's a bit of awkwardness because we're the first to arrive. But our hosts, Cliff and Melody, pour us a nice glass of Valpolicella and tell us to help ourselves from the buffet. Well, I wasn't expecting George Clooney and Angelina Jolie, but the next people to arrive are a disappointment. Think Phil Mitchell off EastEnders and the cashier from your local Asda. They're followed by a man in grey leather slip-ons and a woman with a mahogany tan and too much terracotta lip liner. Grey Shoes pulls Melody onto his lap and fondles her thighs while chatting to Colin about some trouble he's been having with his Volvo. I don't know where to look. More people arrive, and Cliff says, "We may as well get going," and hands around a deep glass bowl. Colin puts down his cheese and crackers and throws in the Nissan keys. Barry White and Love Unlimited are just reaching an orchestral climax when I notice the rolls of kitchen towel dotted around the room. One on the arm of the sofa, another next to the poof, and realise that the faint smell I've been trying to identify since we arrived is in fact disinfectant. All I can think about is fungal infections. Mrs. Lipliner fishes around in the glass bowl and pulls out Colin's car keys. "Over my dead body," I shriek, almost falling over a septuagenarian QC in my effort to wrench them out of her hands. We wrestle briefly, but her patent stilettos pull her off balance, and I manage to pin her to the Axminster. I throw my head back and swallow the key in a single gulp, like a seal swallowing a pilchard. Grey Shoes and Cliff look at me with utter admiration, and Colin is on his feet before you know it, whisking me through the front door, out towards the Nissan, the locked Nissan.
Linda is a swinger, and she's left her keys up here, I should say. The score is very high. I can't add. Don't look at me. It's 34. Astonishing. Well done, Linda. I always thought that about Burgess Hill, actually. I always thought there was a hotbed of swingers. Okay, so I'm going to say that this is Duncan Fats. No, it's Duncan. Duncan is here. Duncan's right at the back. He's giving everyone a good view of himself as he walks through. You can slide up and down. Good. Okay, you get marks on the back of you off that wall, as I discovered earlier when Zoe brushed me down. Okay. Clear.
Oh gosh, what have you done?
Hang on.
Okay. There you go.
Okay, yeah, good.
Okay, we'll press the middle one.
Right then, Duncan, sorry. Away you go.
This is good. There are 9 ships moored. I have a clear view of all of them, and the crates should shield me from detection. However, when to act, that is the question. On patrol with the SAS, sleeping with your ears open, said that timing was critical to any operation. Act too soon and not everything may be in position. Too late and the cover could be blown. My orders were to take this key at any cost, and that's what I'll do. But if you read any of the articles in The Soldier, they all stress the importance of striking cleanly and with minimal non-essential casualties. I've watched Ross Kemp. I've watched Bear Grylls. And I know the importance of the code. Admittedly, when I first heard the name, I thought Bear Grylls was a new type of low-fat frying machine, but now I know better. I will strike cleanly and swiftly and fade into the night, for I am the Shade. Oh, God, who am I kidding? Ever since my mum asked me to change that light bulb for her and I hear myself say, the shade, I get an image of a flower-embroidered light fitting with purple tassels. But it's too late to change it now. I've made the shade my call sign. Oh, well, let's get on with it. It's time to set the night alight. Well, I have to say that for a first job, I think that was rather well done. Target destroyed, no casualties, and back home safe and sound in time for a light supper. Best reporting with the good news, I suppose, as long as I can get this damn radio to work. I'll never buy parts off eBay again. Ah, clear line for once. The shade calling, do you receive? Yes, I damn well receive. What have you been up to? He sounds angry. I wasn't expecting that. I planted and detonated the explosives. Yes, I can see that. It's all over the news. Why did you do that? You told me to. You said, the key is the gateway to the docks. Take them. There is a moment's silence, a sigh, and then in a very measured tone, what I said was, take the key, K-E-Y, not key, Q-U-A-Y, to the gates of the docks. I did not tell you to blow the bloody doors off. It's my turn for a moment's silence, and then all I can think of to say is, ah, I see. I put the radio down and pull the power. Outside the open window, the street is illuminated by flashing blue lights, silhouetting a figure on the rooftop opposite. And faintly, but distinctly, I hear the unmistakable sound of a police standard issue Heck & Koch PSG-1 sniper's rifle being loaded.
And we'll never know.
But does it end with a bang?
See how harsh I am with my bell. I didn't think we'd have the... five? They're straight up with their scores. There's no deliberation. 5-7-5-5. 22. Well done. Thank you, Duncan. I didn't think that we'd have both of the Mitchell brothers mentioned by name. ever at Charleston, let alone before the first half. So I will now take our fourth person, who is going to be... York Stone.
Wait.
The key is to find a person who can host and use a stopwatch.
Right, I'll begin now.
Oh, no, you won't. Okay, I'm so... Zoe really hates me up now. Okay, go.
It was my turn. I braced myself, sucked in the crowd, and began. Those lucky few who live, who love, who really matter, they're the shadows to dance with, to become. Not the deep cracks, the mosquitoes, the mystery rot. They're the flecks of black, dark back, blood black, to dance past. To hack on knowingly right by. Don't hack knowledge, acknowledge the dance, the dance. A drunken buffoon hollered from the back. Anyone got a guitar? A guitar, I asked. I can't play one. Play one, he bellowed back. I want to smash it over your head. The crowd roared. I stage left, to the bar, to solace and sympathy with Canadian Penny, the barmaid. I liked your dance, she said. I started chewing on a bottle of Budweiser. Just piss. You know, she continued, persevere. That's the key. It'll unlock what you're trying to say. I considered saying, can I unlock your tiny Canadian panties? But held back, just chewed on more piss. A few more open micers got up, said their bits, received kind applause, drunk their pinos, smoked outside and disappeared in their BMWs. I clung to the bar, perving at Penny. wondering if she tasted like maple syrup. Persevere, that's what she said. I knew a kid at school called Percy DeVere, a keen pianist, fluent French, fine opening bat. Wonder what he's doing now. Probably far better off than me. Probably got 1,000 keys. Probably a fucking locksmith. I chewed and chugged until closing time, the last swinging dick in the place. Penny was the last of the staff. My eyes pulsed, my head heaved, but hell, persevere. I hit the toilets, swilled my face cool, gazed out the back window. The magical night fabric was bookshot with sizzling stars. The big gay moon showered the hunkered downtown in beautiful milk. A single boat bobbed in the wedge of popping night sea. Someone had persevered at this picture, all right, a masterpiece. I lolloped back into the bar, revitalized, ready. Penny was at the drinker's side, lights out. The cigarette machine shone a Camel logo across her face. Her shadow hovered. She smiled 1,000 perfect white teeth, her eyes jigged. On the bar was her house key. I want to acknowledge the dance, she whispered to me. Meet me at mine. I gotta lock up here. My nuts and bolts bounced. She spun and slid off through a door to the back somewhere. I looked at the key, man, I was high, higher than a nightingale.
Round of applause! Distinct case of audience blue balls there. I am drinking Pinot. It has been noted by Yorkshire, very cleverly. I don't have a BMW. I would like to, however, invite to the stage.
Oh, are we doing another one there? He hasn't decided.
Five, six, six, seven, a very good score. Which is?
24.
Oh, good. Okay. I like the Penny accent a lot. Somebody's put a blank one in. Is it going to be revealed if I hold it up to the light, or is it just a mistake? And David Chowcat, who I remember from last year, please come to the stage. David. He apparently is coming from Lewis. Oh, here he comes. Right. Okay, wait there. Yeah, we're ready. Yeah. Go ahead, Mr. Chowcat.
Okay, the key. As I walked towards the back of the little bookshop, clutching the key to the safe in my hand, I thought of Eugene in the kitchen. Fate, I heard him say, makes victims of us all. The vital thing is to find the key to our life, and then we can take destiny into our hands. Eugene sits back and holds out his fat hands as if ready to catch as destiny drops from the skies. Meanwhile, I'm busy setting the trap, wondering what it was about these mice, why I should hate them so much, scuttling around in the kitchen at night while I'm upstairs trying to sleep. Ah, Eugene, I thought as I turned the key in the safe door, he should have been a philosopher. And he probably would have been, had he not met his destiny that day under the wheels of the RE teacher's car. I can still see his startled eyes gazing myopically at the heavens as his blood puddled on the roadway. A small brown blur was scuttling along the gutter. A chill spread over me. Now, holding the safe door open with one hand, I bent down to pick up my shoulder bag and came face to face with the old man staring at the ceiling. A little like Eugene, I thought, except Eugene didn't have a knife sticking out from his chest. I made a mental note to remove it before I left. Not now, too messy. How many hours I'd spent in here squatting behind the dusty shelves, squinting between the yellowing volumes as the old man counted his takings and shuffled to the safe. A hoarder, I thought. You never go to the bank. You'd rather keep your eye on your money. With the key in your hand, you thought destiny was yours to control. How cruelly destiny deceived you. I pulled a thick wad of notes from the safe. My new life starts here, I thought, as I pushed them into my bag. But as I pulled out the next bunch of notes, I noticed something odd about them. Something about the size, something about the colour, something about the large pair of ears and the grin on the portrait on the right-hand side. The nose, too, something rodent-like. I stared at Mickey. Mickey stared at me. I pulled more notes out of the safe, all with the mouse. Not even a duck or a dog. How could this be? A familiar cold chill spread over me. Had I ever seen anyone else in the shop? Was it not always perfectly plain the old man was quite insane? I looked down at the old man. Death grinned up at me. I never go out now. I've locked myself in and thrown away the key. I carefully portion out each small piece of cheese. At night, the mice gather around my bed and serenade me until dawn.
And, of course, of all the teachers, it would be the RE teacher that ran somebody over. Next, well, I score, sorry. I'm so premature. I can't. 8, 4, 5, and 7. Oh, no, that created a ripple of woo. 24 again, the magic number. I should say that if you are coming up to read, and I do love all of you who come up to read, if you can kind of make sure you've slightly got me in your eye line, because when you get to about sort of 10 seconds to go, I'll give you a really dirty look. Jacqueline Malloy. Jacqueline's got a lot of family with her there. It's okay, Jacqueline. I know you're scared right now. They're quite nice, really.
Okay. I hope
so. Step forward so we can hear you.
I will.
Lovely. Okay, are you ready?
I am.
Go.
The key. A roaring fire. Christmas tree draped with tinsel and baubles. Snow outside. Warm and cozy inside. One present under the tree. My name on the tag. I rip into the gold and red paper and smile. At last, my very own. Wake up! My brother interrupts my dream and kicks me in the ribs. I curl into a ball and tell myself to breathe, breathe. He'll soon get bored and go and torture a cat. I keep my eyes tightly closed, but he pinches one lid open. Green snot glued to his nostrils, yellow buck teeth. Finally, he lets my lid drop. His heavy footsteps descend the stairs. I wish he'd fall through them, into a steaming pit full of ugly beasts who tear him to pieces, slowly. Happy Christmas, I whisper to myself. Downstairs, Dad has tried hard. The single bar electric fire is on. A string of purple tinsel hangs across the chipped mantelpiece. Two of his thick work socks pinned to it. My brother has raided his, discarded the orange, eaten the chocolate coins, and is now engrossed in his shiny black Nintendo. I sniff my orange, stash the chocolate in my secret dressing gown pocket. Loose, at the bottom of my sock, is a piece of folded paper. I open it to find a small plastic key. My brother snorts. Stupid present for a stupid girl. Dad smiles at me encouragingly. I read the note on the paper. It says, garden shed under the workbench. I leave slowly so my brother doesn't notice. I want to run with excitement, but I know better. Never let the enemy know your intentions. It's the shiny red and green wrapped present from my dream. I tear at the paper. It is my very own Tressie doll. I stroke her short blonde hair, Then I turn her over, slip her silver dress to one side to reveal the small opening in her back. I insert the key and twist it. I'm mesmerized as her hair grows and falls over my fingers. I'm going to call you Rapunzel, I tell her. And I imagine shimmying down her thick mane to the house with the roaring fire. I hide the magic key in my secret pocket with the chocolate coins.
Dolls are usually so creepy in stories, and that was a nice doll. I like that doll. Scores? 5, 4, 5. Oh, gosh, you're getting so fast. 21. One round of applause. So we have a couple more to go before our interval. And Tim Cregan. Please come up, Tim Cregan. Where are you? He's right at he's literally right at the back. I should probably tell you a short story while he's on his way. What's he wearing? I'm trying to work out who he is. It's a tracksuit, is it? He's looking quite, he's ready for something. Come on, Tim. Oh, it's not a tracksuit, I'm sorry, it's a cardigan. Oh, wait there. Any good stopwatches, Tim, or do you want to? So sorry. We should just do analogue next time. Okay. You ready? Yeah? Okay. Go.
Focus. Visualise your goal. Harness your strengths. There's no failure, only temporary obstacles, opportunities for learning. Stay on the path you've chosen. Do not waver. Others may mock or criticise. Ignore them, it's just words driven by fear or envy. Do this and you'll achieve success. That's from The Key to Success. It's changed my life, really helped me. I mean, I was never that cool or funny or good looking. I never had a girlfriend. In fact, I used to get teased. Quite a lot, actually. But none of that matters now. I just focus on my goal. My goal is pussy. I am focused. I visualise my goal. My strengths are obsessive single-mindedness and the fact that I seem kind of harmless. I met Sarah at work. I asked her out. We went out. She was really nice. I thought, oh, we had a good time and later on we ended up back at hers. I thought, this could be it. She wants me. I went to kiss her, but I got nervous. I wavered. I was weak. And she saw. She asked me, have you never... But then she said, it's okay. It doesn't matter. She was kind and gentle. But it felt wrong. The key says you should remain in control. Be strong. Stay focused on the goal. Don't waver. I got a bit upset. Mistakes were made. I don't deny that. I was angry with myself. And, well, I'm pretty certain I won't be seeing Sarah again. But that's okay. The key says there's no failure, only temporary obstacles, learning opportunities. And it doesn't matter what other people say about you, whether they call you dangerous or violent, criminal, psychopath. They're only words. I'm stronger now, clearer. I've had time to think, I've learned from my mistakes, I've stayed focused on my goal, and when they let me out of here, I really think I will achieve success.
How much does Tim need to hook up with Linda and Burgess Hill? How badly does that need to happen? 8, 7, 7, and 6. 28. Round of applause there. Woo! And this is going to be our final flasher, but before the break, Celine West. Don't you come? Welcome. Round of applause for Celine. You're going to have to move closer to the microphone and say, right, you ready? Yeah. Go.
The gatekeeper keeps his gate, a white wrought iron affair with curlicues and swirls, metal leaves chasing lines of entry. He keeps it clean and he keeps it safe, standing sentry for eons. The grass grows under his feet. Every 42nd day he dresses in Japanese armour and holds in front of the gate an oak staff that supports a scathing tempered blade with a long tang. He wards off casual explorers. The one he's waiting for will come like a comet blazing a black trail through the grass. The keymaster has wild hair that smells of burning. He roams the universe searching for the gate with a mobile phone clamped to one ear, and blue suede trainers so worn that the foam from inside them is bursting out behind his ankles. He makes smoke appear from behind mirrors. His ashcan stare makes ladies' underwear drop to their knees. Children squeal with delight as he rushes past them on the pavement. He keeps the key on a length of royal elastic pinned to the waistband of his elegant boxers. What will happen when the keymaster finds the gate, fits his key into that welcoming lock, that rust-free, dust-free, slick, oiled hole that was made to embrace this one key and this key only? The gatekeeper knows. He alone knows. They kept that from the keymaster to fire him up, stir up his curiosity to the hot heights it now licks. He would not search the universe if he knew, nah-uh, he'd hang up those old trainers by their shredded laces. He'd make a home and stay there, put his feet up on a wicker stool in front of a fireplace stuffed with smokeless coal, his butt sagging in a leather wing back and a cat licking its balls on his lap. He'd chew the end of his unlit cohiba and say, to hell with that plan.
Lucky, lucky cat. The judges are deciding and they're... Oh, I can't see one of those. Six? Four, thank you. 6, 4, 7, 6. It's not 24 again, is it? 23. Very good. Well done. And a huge thank you to everyone who's been up in the first half. Sarah, Linda, Duncan, York, Zone, David, Jacqueline, Tim and Celine. We are going to take about kind of 10-15 minute break now, during which I urge you to, of course, drink more and to buy books because the bookshop is going to close in a little while. So I'll see you all back here in 10 minutes. So welcome back, everyone. I'm pleased to see that you're all refreshed, i.e. tipsy. I have a special surprise treat for you, as if this evening wasn't pleasure and joy enough. Naomi Alderman, whose books I have in my hand right here, Disobedience and the Lessons. Look at those. They are available to buy in the shop. Naomi is here and has very kindly written flash fiction for us on the key. She's also not going to be in the competition, as that would perhaps be unfair, but she may well be judged. So please welcome Naomi Alderman.
Hello. Oh, yes. I have to move it down because Damien is a full foot taller than me. Yes, do judge me and ring your bell at me.
I will ring my bell at you. Okay, are you ready? Go.
It weighs heavy in the hand now. Heavier than you'd think. When you see it in the bowl in the junk shop, you try to pick it up by looping your index finger through the curlicued metal head. But it's too heavy for that. It takes a clasped palm, flakes of rust crackling on your skin. What does it open? You say. The man behind the counter, with his half-moon glasses and his little pot belly, smiles. Shrugs. You'll know it when you see it. You probably shouldn't buy it. Your flat is too cluttered already. You buy it anyway. That night, you dream of a door, three great iron bars across it, all locked with a single key. There's something behind that door. It's shuffling. It's very old. It's been there a long time. It's angry. It shouldn't have enough energy for this, but you hear it taking a run, thundering feet. At the moment before it slams its weight into the door, you wake up, sweating, shaking. In the middle of the night, you take the key out of your bedroom. You sleep without dreams. In the morning, finding the key on your dining table, you chide yourself. But you don't move it back. Life goes on. You meet people. You fall in love. Your love does not end well at all. You are angry. You take a long holiday. You do not intend to take the key with you. But when you arrive, there it is, in your case. This sort of thing has been happening a lot. Some desire is working itself out in you. The woman who cleans your room fingers the key. It's time now, isn't it? She says. You nod. I'll know it when I see it. And you do. In this hot country, in a maze of streets, as if you'd always known the way. There is the door you'd seen in your dream. You know what you'll have to give up. You don't care. You're angry. You want revenge. You heft the key in your hand. Do I get judged?
Oh, yes, you get judged.
Shame!
But the judges are like, oh, no, don't make me judge her. She's doing an event tomorrow. She might not do it if she doesn't get 10. Well, 10 and 8... 9 and a 9. I think that makes you the winner, but you're not winning. Well done. Thank you, Naomi. Naomi wrote it this afternoon in her purple satin pyjamas over at Tilton House. Okay, so next up is Mrs. Ruth Maxwell, who, judging from the reaction that she's like just won the lottery, is the lady in the front. So, shall we... I don't think she's not going to get up here, so we will bring the microphone to you.
Okay, is it coming through?
Almost. Oh, can we hear you? Can you hear it back? Okay. Right, hit it, Ruth. You're on.
Okay, the key. It had been a long, hard day. We had moved from a dark basement flat to our new home. There was no cottage in the country. No, a semi, lost in a sea of other semis, but it was all we could afford. Afford? The mortgage was crippling, but at least we were on the property ladder. I'm so sorry I have to go out on our first night here, darling, I told my wife. But it's imperative I attend tonight's dinner. My promotion depends on it. I'll be home as early as I can. Leave the front door key under the mat. I was later home than I'd anticipated. I found the key, let myself in, and quietly crept up the stairs, dropped my clothes, and slipped into the bed. I snuggled up to the sleeping body, gently kissed her cheek, and was soon asleep. It was the dawn chorus that woke me, not something heard in our previous home. I opened my eyes to unfamiliar furniture, bright green curtains. I froze in shock, and the woman I was cuddling up to was a brunette, and my wife is a blonde. The realization that I was in the wrong bed, the wrong house, had me creeping nervously from the bed, and clutching my clothes, departing cautiously through the front door. I checked the house number, 37 and our home was 39. I slipped over the adjoining hedge, took the key from under the doormat, and was soon in my own bed, cuddling my own wife. She opened her eyes. Darling, you must have been back late last night. I didn't hear you. She giggled and said, I've met our next-door neighbour. He's a heavyweight boxer. He was just driving up for an out-of-town fight. And then she dozed off again. I thought. I leant out of the bed, checked my clothes piled on the floor. Yes, they all seemed to be there. But I froze suddenly. Only one shoe. Oh, my God, where was the other?
And if somebody can just make sure that Ruth gets back to the right house tonight, that'd be marvellous. Or possibly the wrong house. 6, 6, 7, and 7. 26. I think... we'll come back to that. Next. Nikki Daly. Sounds like a detective from a 1980s TV show. Nikki Daly, please come up. There will be a moment while I faff with this, sorry. Oh, bollocks, Sally. I love all these really impatient people who are like, for God's sake, just work. Thank you. It involves numbers, and therefore I'm not very good at it. Welcome. Are you
Thank
ready?
You.
Go.
Nervous.
Don't be nervous, just go.
He looked at her. She looked away. I don't know what you're talking about, she said. He snorted contemptuously, sighed inwardly and clenched his jaw. The small hand of the kitchen clock sliced through the silence. Tick, tock, tick, tock. Stupid bitch. He didn't have time for this. This wasn't how it should be. She flicked her heavy hair back, as she always did, and gingerly touched her left cheek. He stared, stony-eyed. His fingers slid towards the right trouser pocket, straightened, then curled around his knife. What will it take to make her tell me? How different it had been then, another universe. Arms linked, she emerged, chattering, giggling, part of a gaggle of long-limbed, long-lashed girls cascading down the worn grey stone steps. He watched her for days. Knew her routine, her friends, her hours spent in the university library. Later her lips, her body enveloping his, nuzzling and nibbling, in an embrace that seemed to stop time. An internal wrap that would bind her to him forever. A spinning world of bedtime, nighttime, their time. Who was he? I really don't know what you're talking about. Cold, oh so cold. Just tell me, I need to know. Her caramel milk thighs, jutting hip bone and dense black hair. His buttocks clenched involuntarily as he spat out the words, emphasising each syllable. I saw you. Who was he? Faces tilted towards each other, arms interlocked, their footsteps beating out a familiar beat. They shimmied down Main Street, emerging effortlessly with the shoppers. Waves of jealousy enveloped him, making him nauseous. Bile rose in his gullet, burnt his throat. You're crazy. Please just let me go. Red. They say you see red, but the cut was clean, incisive. He hadn't forgotten. In the silence, his mobile trilled, a text. Reaching over, he opened the message. Hey, can you tell the difference? Given Sapphire my key. Be nice to my twin. See you at 7, Jay.
all gone quite saucy tonight, hasn't it? Dirty twins in Burgess Hill. Mike Council. Oh, wait there, sorry. Well, oh, okay, wait there. We'll do Mike again. We'll do it and we'll be surprised. It'll be an acting lesson. 7, 5, 6, and 6, which is 24. Well done, Nikki Daly. Oh, look, Mike Council. Please welcome Mike. Go.
Keys accumulate. You can measure your life in them. Jonathan had developed a habit of playing with his, scrunching them, jingling them. Rings intermingled with rings, miniature supermarket loyalty cards mixed with miniature gym membership cards, and his work ID. Central was a large, bright blue Smurf riding a skateboard, won by his daughter Gemma at a Penny Falls machine at the fair, and presented with such enormous solemnity he hadn't the heart not to attach it to the large, spiky ball. He turned the heavy mass of metal over in his hand, trying to locate the right dividing point and the right ring for the right key. Gemma, the most 8-year-old girl in the world, only had one key, a tiny heart-shaped thing which she loved to fit into a heart-shaped musical jewellery box, allowing her to ease open the lid and watch a badly painted ballerina spring up awkwardly and pirouette at a 45-degree angle to something that was quite close to the tune of the Sugar Plum Fairy. She loved to watch it. He loved to watch her watching it. Jonathan's first key had been the back door key when he was 14. His mum had started work, and he could still remember the look on her face as she told him how much of a responsibility this was, how much it signified his growing maturity. When he closed his eyes, he could still feel the coarseness of the string that held it round his neck. He could still hear the mockery of Mr. Pitt, the PE teacher, who could exploit a weakness at 200 yards, inviting the rest of the class to guess how much the weight of the key would slow his skinny frame, to assess the likelihood of long-lasting rib damage as the key bounced against his chest running the cross-country, to debate whether it was dragging down through the mud if he fell. So he bought a keyring with his pocket money, with a fob of a skull, like 14-year-olds should have, black with red eyes, and concealing a clip with which he could attach it to his belt loop. And he began that lifelong process, the acquisition of keys. Front door keys, back door keys, bike keys, car keys, filing cabinet keys, parent keys, garage keys, work keys, and lastly a key given that shouldn't have been taken, a key whose anonymity amongst the mass he'd erroneously taken for granted. It was only now he realised it wasn't a one-way process, the accumulation of keys. There was a point in life when they could leave, and he reached that point. The first to go had been the wrong one, hurled dramatically away to no effect. The second was this one, and as he handed back what was until today the front door key to what was until today his wife, he wondered what would go next. Garage keys, probably, then the cars. He wondered if one day, lost in lonely old age, he'd shuffle down the street with a weighted string around his neck again, and he wondered if he'd ever see a heart-shaped key open a heart-shaped box.
They're really getting it now, that if you like it, cheer thing. 8-4, Diana's struggling to... Oh. The judges don't have security. 8, 4, 9, and 9. Great disagreement at the back. I love there was a slight kind of ripple of horror at the description of the PE teacher. It's a sure way to get a room on your side, a room of bookish people, talk about the horror of a PE teacher. We have all been there, and I still hate mine. Unluckily for him, Bloomsbury have just bought my memoir. Great. Anyway, so... 12. Sarah Hawthorne, or perhaps it's Sarah. Sarah, Sarah, please come to the stage. She's coming all the way from the back. She appears to be blonde. It's not natural. It looks good. Good. Go.
Swings always made me seasick. The rhythmic to and fro that brought such unhinged delight to other children made me a green-faced laughingstock. And so I took to sitting in the shadowed grass of the park, picking absently at daisies and lusting through squinting eyes at childish games. It was there that the key presented itself, a beautiful mess of Gothic knotwork and burnished metal. I pressed it deep into my flesh, dirt, grass and all, relishing the spike of pain from the jagged edges which once might have opened infinite possibilities. I slid the key into my pocket, and the secret thrill wound up my arm and spread across my body like paint blown through a straw. I continued to sit there in the grass, watching the shadows lengthen and clutching my prize until one by one my callous playmates wandered in the direction of homemade dinners and bedtime stories. Eventually, there was only one head of hair left gleaming in the late afternoon sun. She had her back to me, and I watched the wavy golden tendrils whip and blow as she propelled herself skywards, lost in the bliss of rushing wind and adrenaline of momentary freedom. Even looking at her was making me nauseous. I walked over to stand in the slipstream of her euphoria, but she slowed her pace and the feeling wilted, as if my envy had sucked it from her. She turned and looked me up and down, a sorry sight of pallid limbs and matted hair, then laughed in the mortifying way that only bullies can. She dismissed me with an arrogant flick of her head and threw herself backwards, rushing towards my measly frame in a blur of rubber, chain and hair. I didn't move. I folded over her like a wounded soldier as the impact lifted me and swung me out over the grass before dragging me forward once more. As our momentum slowed, a searing pain in my hand reached through my queasiness, and as I hauled myself upright, I saw that there, buried deep in her pale neck and surrounded by luminous vines of our blood, was my beautiful key.
No sugar or spice in that little girl, and I expect the judges to give that Scottish girl a very high score. I can't think why. No, I'm teasing you. 6 and 5 and 5 and 5. Round of applause, Sarah Hawthorne. We have 4 more to go. 4 more, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 in the hat. Jonathan Foxwell, where are you? Up you get. So you were here last year, weren't you? So many, one of our many repeats. We have, I think, 5 tonight. So. I finally worked out after how many people how to do the stopwatch. You're on.
Hello. My name is Bartholomew Jones, and I'm an alcoholic. The last time I shared with you, I told you I'd been sober for 9 months. I can't say that to you now. I'd get aggressive with my wife. She'd leave the house, and then I'd be able to get to my stash of vodka in the attic. She left me under a year ago. Took Archie and Daisy with her. Not that I blame her. Old habits die hard, I guess. I phoned her last week. I needed to fight with her so I could drink. Life drifts blissfully away. Street noise mutes out into a low hum, broken only by the sound of clinking bottles from the carrier bags in my hand. There's a gnawing pain in my cheek from the iron of the arm of a bench. Delirium trebens keep me warm as I shake, coatless, under the trees. I hear the sound of a dying soul as my moaning laces the air with terror. I think of Archie and Daisy and myself as a boy. I weep. I have to stop myself imagining what I'd do to protect a child from this harrowing. Then something incredible happened. I came to as the sun began to break over the park. I could still see the stars as midnight turned to a warm orange. Birdsong, more profound than any magnum opus, overwhelmed my shame. Wonder ravaged me. It dominated me like thunder crackling through the carcass of my spirit, willing it to live. I lifted myself up and bathed in the afterglow of my surrender. I am a child who was rescued by beauty. My friends, I think I may have found the key. A key that opened me. A key that never left me.
So the judges are shuffling 5, 7, 6, and 4. 22. The judges are harsh. You get to vote on the judges at the end with your bunched fists. Now, I rather like the sound of Barbara Hudson. Where is she? Barbara Hudson. Come on. And she's highly visible in her pink. Up you come. You ready?
Right.
On you go.
Joan is at a party watching her handsome husband, James. He's dancing with a pretty fair-haired girl in a tiny miniskirt. The girl has big dangly earrings and bright red lipstick. As they turn in the dance, Joan suddenly notices that James's hand is unnecessarily low on the girl's back. He is stroking her bottom. The music stops. Surely James will leave the girl and come back to her now. But the music starts again, and James doesn't seem to be concerned about Joan at all. He resumes the dancing and the stroking. Joan goes upstairs. She has to ask a snogging couple to move in order to fumble through the pile on the bed for her coat and James's jacket. She feels the jacket carefully, and yes, the car key is in the pocket. Clutching the key, she goes and looks again at James and the blonde. Now they're kissing. She fancies she sees pitying looks on the faces of friends as she makes for the front door, humiliated as well as betrayed. Nervously, she turns the key in the ignition. Usually James is the driver. Indeed, he calls the sleek red Lotus my car, while she calls it ours. She thinks of that as she drives it cautiously home, enters the dark flat, downs a brandy, and goes to bed. The hours pass. She sobs and she waits. 1, 2, 3, 4 a.m. Then, running footsteps on the stairs, James flings open the bedroom door. For a brief moment, Joan wonders if he is going to apologize. But no. He yells at her. How could you? You just didn't think, did you? I looked out of the window and my car was gone. I thought it had been stolen. You never asked me if you could take it. Sneaking away like that, I made a perfect fool of myself going on about it till I found the key was gone from my pocket. You know how much my car means to me.
Hate James and his car. Hate them. Scores 7, 6, 7, and 5. I just read them out. Don't hate me. 25. Okay, so next. Actually, as part of my ongoing inability to add, there are in fact three more people and not two, as I earlier said. So that's a little bit better. Is that worrying you? Oh, one of those was a seven. Okay. Oh, okay. Carol Vorderman, come back. So, Patrick Jenkins, where are you, Patrick Jenkins? Welcome.
Paul Morris, 58, vital statistics, married with two children, multi-millionaire owner of tidy homes, regarded as highly organised and methodical. In fact, even in his private life, he had to be meticulously organised. The books in his bookcase were arranged in height. His extensive stamp collection was carefully, neatly arranged in albums. Saucepans were stacked in order, and every holiday was planned to the last details, including the obligatory trip to the local McDonald's. Some people said it was an obsession, and Paul wondered at times why it had become that way. His fortune, he believed, was certainly not due to his education. He had packed off to boarding school at the age of 13. His parents had told him that education was the key, and that it would open his mind and enlighten him. Sadly, education did not provide the key to greater knowledge. In fact, he reflected he could now remember little of what he was meant to have learnt. The teaching was taught passed him by like some motorway skirting a city. A traffic of information failed to get past the go sign. History stayed in the dark ages. Geography was all at sea. In maths, trying to calculate where the ship was at point C from point A was, as far as he was concerned, was that it sunk on the rocks. French also provided a big gnaw to any progress. Even now, the only word in Latin Paul remembered was a mow, which reminded him that he had to cut the lawn. The teachers he could vaguely remember. There was a headmaster known as Duke, who from time to time would appear from behind the lectern to announce that leave will be given to visit the Odeon. John Knox, the deputy, Tony the tank, and Ned the head of English, who constantly searched his pockets as if was missing. All tried valiantly to open this key to learning, and entered, but either the key wouldn't turn or not enough WD-40 was applied. In fact, the only thing Paul did really remember was a French bop button striding down the corridor, bopping away, and repeatedly say, "Organisation, boys, is the key to success."
But just, I know only have a few of you left, but just so you know, it always feels faster. So Patrick could even have gone a little bit more slowly because he did a very good time of, what was it, 2 minutes and 4 seconds. So 6, 4, 4, and 4. You guys are getting a kicking afterwards. Okay. We have, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 2 more to go. So the penultimate person reading tonight will be, I'm really not sure how to say this, Kiri Cracker, or Cooker, perhaps. Do you want to correct me? How is it? Cooker? Cooker?
Yes, perfect. That's right. You even did the French
pronunciation.
I don't even do that.
Oh. Right. And go.
We look up at her, expectantly, but she doesn't move a muscle. She is small and stocky with crinkled skin. She has a key. We want the key. Wisps of black hair lash out in the wind. But the rest of her is hidden, folded beneath a thick Tibetan shawl. She has the key. We want the key. Our oars dip into the rippling reflective sky. Our faces glow in the light of the dying sun. It is cold on the boat, and our white breath curls on the mist. I think about Barry, about how much he loved me. We float between sky and sea, and I wish earnestly for the wood to split. for both worlds to collide and swallow me whole. The woman stands up and opens her shawl, holding it out like a cormorant's wing. The key is pinned to the cloth, glimmering. Yet, now I see it, how small and ordinary. Did I really risk all for something so little, so insignificant? The others are rising. Fathers, children, mothers, partners. They want the key, they want the key. One by one they lunge for it, the key, the key. One by one she flicks them overboard. They fall into the water and into the sky. It is just us now, her and me. She takes a key and holds it out to me, and I take it in my hands. I finger its grooves and sharp edges, and suddenly I'm back at my front door. I turn, but all else is shadow. So I push in the key, wriggle it till it clicks, then bump my hip against the door. I walk through the corridor, see myself slumped on the dining room floor, the empty bottle, the vomited pills. What a fucking mess.
An intensely brusque 1 minute and 59 seconds. We're getting a bit of feedback here. Does anyone know why that might be happening? No? Okay, stop now anyway. It's over. Okay, so there is one spot left, and there are... Oh. Yeah. There's a spot left for a host next year.
They're quite high, actually. Eight.
8, 6, 4, and 8. Okay, so back to the tension building moment. There are 4 names left in the hat. Joey, do you want to pick the last one out? Would that be fair? I think it would. Go on. I saw this lady writing her name earlier. It's Deborah O'Donoghue. Where are you, Deborah? Up you come. Welcome to the last person of the night. But not least. Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, go.
The key. She only notices me when I'm not in my place. I sit and wait in the corner where she tossed me, under the magazine she discarded on top of me, in the coat pocket, forgotten. I can wait for hours, days. I'm just a spare to her. Eventually she comes looking. That's the only time she really wants me. I can hear her urgency in the slamming of drawers and scrape of her breath. But when she finally discovers me, she simply tuts, grabs me, holds me briefly before dropping me into her bag, and off she goes again. The touch of her skin is warm against my cold metal ridges. For all the time I wait dangling on the hook exactly where she wants me, she never shows any gratitude. She barely even sees me, yet I'm always here. I'm the one who provides warmth, shelter, security. At least I try. On a cold day, as the rain comes down and she has no coat and has forgotten her umbrella again, sometimes I feel the flicker of her relief as she lays her hand on me. But other times, she totters home, fumbling for me, sometimes laughing with a stranger, and reaches for me, but hardly looks at me as she thrusts me into the door. More than once, she's dropped me, and I lay on the floor, her red heels and long legs stretching up away from me. Sometimes she gives me to him, whichever one it is that day. And I have to suffer that indignity, the rough hand of a stranger deftly slotting me away, using me for access. Once, I was held against her cheek and neck so hard that my imprint was left, and my edges grazed her. I felt her tremble.
Minutes and 14 seconds and all very enjoyable. 8, 8, 8, and 8. Which I think is 32. So, only because you wrote it. So our four finalists, therefore, are, and I would like them to come to the stage as I say their names, the Swinger of Burgess Hill. Deborah O'Donoghue, please come back. Mike Council, please join me. And can Zoe, which is the next highest number of the four?
Deborah.
Well, we've got Deborah. So who's there? Are four.
Sorry. Can anyone see it?
It's 28. It is Tim. Tim Cregan, where are you? Has he done the maths himself and arrived? Oh, there he is. No, he's not here. Where is he, Tim? Oh, is that the man that I accused? The man I accused of being in a tracksuit. I'm going to make an executive decision as well, and I'm going to put Ruth in there because I really loved that story about waking up next to the wrong person. But I won't ask you to come up. So basically, we have our four and five because I can finalists. And what I'd like you to do is read the first line of your story again, in the order that you read them. Have you brought your stories with you? Linda hasn't. Okay, Linda, do you want to go and get your story? Go on, then. Anybody else want to go and get their story, or have you all got them? Okay, Linda's going to get her story. And what's going to happen is that it's going to be judged at this point on the applause, not by the judges, who you've now sidestepped neatly and can shun. It will be judged by applause, and it will be judged by me. So, okay. I'm going to stand back. So and we'll do it in order. You're in order, right, aren't you? No, you're not. You're there. And Tim, are you? Yeah, okay, right, go. And Ruth, where does Ruth come in? Yeah. So Linda, step up, please. Welcome, Linda.
It was Colin's suggestion. Come on, he says. You're always complaining we don't do things as a couple. It might be fun.
I just love that Colin, the judge, is sitting in the front row, blushing to the very roots of his soul. As if he even knows what she's talking about. Okay, and I'll become Tim.
Welcome.
Focus. Visualize your goal. Harness your strengths. Through them, you'll attain your goal.
I think the thing that's so disturbing about that is it's so kind of sleazy. It's real. It's that just like that. What's that self? The Game or The Rules? One of those. Dreadful. Not for sale in our bookshop. So please welcome Mike.
Keys accumulate. You can measure your life in them.
And Ruth, can we put the roaming mic on, please?
Oh,
there we go.
It had been a long, hard day. We had moved from a dark basement flat to our new home.
Okay, which leaves our final person. Deborah, please come back.
She only notices me when I'm not in my place.
Okay. The person, well, before I tell you who's won, I should say that everyone who hasn't won tonight, everyone who's taken part, has been fantastic, and I absolutely love doing this event. So I want to say thank you to all of you, especially to the people who have written stories, and I'm sorry to the people who didn't get to read, but hopefully next year you will. Those who aren't first tonight will get some Small Wonder beer, which I'm assured is very good. I should quickly tell you that the ending to the story from York Stone, who I cut off, I did want to know, so I went and asked him what happened with the Canadian woman in the bar. He explained that the protagonist didn't get laid. He, in fact, peed himself from drinking all that Budweiser. That won't happen with the Small Wonder beer. And I hope that it doesn't happen to our winner, who is Linda McVeigh.